Yeah. This is File 77. This is Jean McMillan. I'm interviewing Donald Malin at the Scoville Memorial Library. Today's date is August 20th, 2014. May I have your name?
My name is Donald Malin.
And your birth date?
January 1st, 1945.
Your birthplace?
Brooklyn, New York.
Your parents' names?
Edwin S. Malin and Ethel M. Malin.
Did you have siblings?
Yes. I had a brother named Paul.
What's your educational background?
I went through high school on Long Island at W.C. Meppham High School.
W.C. which?
Meppham, M-E-P-H-A-M.
Thank you.
And then went off to the University of Vermont, where I got a bachelor's degree in economics. And then went into the Navy, went to Officer Kennedy School in the Navy, and then 3 years as an officer in the Navy. And then I came out and went back to school and got a master's of education degree.
Where did you get that degree from?
From American International College in Springfield, Mass.
Now, I want the whole story. How did you come to this area?
My parents, actually my grandparents prior to that, used to come up here on vacation at the old Interlaken and the Wake Robin Inn. And as early as I can remember, my parents and I and my brother, we would come up and spend weekends here swimming in the lake. So the family knew this area well, and the family had a manufacturing business. It started in Brooklyn, ended up on Long Island, or it didn't end up on Long Island, it went to Long Island. And then when my dad took it over and semi-retired, he brought it to Lakeville, Connecticut, which is an area he knew.
And the name of the company?
Malin Chime Company.
Thank you.
I was just about getting out of the Navy when he moved to this area and said, you know what, Dad, I need a job.
Yes, son, I know.
Right. And I had always worked at least part-time from the time I can remember, 10, 12 years old, helping out in the shop. And so I went to work for Malin Chime Company. That was 1970.
Tell me a little bit about Malin Chime Company, please.
It was a business started by my great-grandfather, who was in the Civil War, and he was a good musician. He played flute, he played trumpet, he played all kinds of instruments. So he was in the fife and drum corps in the Civil War, stationed up in Elmira, New York, which was a large prison camp at that time. When he got out of when the war ended, and he decided to start his own business, and he did repairs on all kinds of musical instruments, from concertinas to violins to. But then he got into the manufacturing of bells, and he made handbells. The largest business they did in those days was with vaudeville. Vaudeville had all kinds of acts. They made bells that Annie Oakley shot at with off of her horse and played tunes.
Oh, my word.
They made bells for the circuses and carnivals and things like that. It evolved into a business with my grandfather where they made chimes for the Seth Thomas Clock Company. And actually other companies that needed signaling devices. And then they also started manufacturing cathedral chimes at that time. It then evolved into basically manufacturing cathedral chimes. And then with the advent of electronics, it all began to wither. Malin chimes are still manufactured by Organ Supply Industries out in Erie, Pennsylvania, actually.
And we have the Google information on that.
Okay, good.
I think besides the Malin Chime Company, you also worked at Hotchkiss.
Little by little, I started at Hotchkiss. It was 1970. I'd just gotten out of the Navy. While I was in high school and college, I pole vaulted and ran hurdles. And I decided I'd like to get out so I could help out coaching. And a great guy named Dave Coughlin was the head coach. And I spoke to him at Hotchkiss, and he said, sure, we'd love to have you. So
Dave
I,
who?
Coughlin, C-O-U-G-H-L-I-N. So I volunteer coached there for, I guess it would have been 2 years. And then through knowing people on the faculty and everything, I heard that they were looking for a part-time economics teacher. So I ventured to step into that position, which I did do. And then Bill Olson, who was then the headmaster at Hotchkiss, spoke to me about would I be interested in coming full-time on the faculty. They were looking for someone to live in a new, actually it was an old building, but it was being converted into a dormitory. And it was a beautiful apartment, bigger than the house we were living in, and I said, sure. So I ended up full-time at Hotchkiss, part-time at Mail and Chime Company, until we finally sold the remains of the business.
When did you first come to Hotchkiss? What year?
1973-74, that academic year.
And when did you actually,
the year
retired.
I retired. Officially it was 2007, although I continued to teach for probably two more years after that.
Hotchkiss. Yeah,
right.
you flunked retirement.
Right.
How did you get involved with scuba diving?
When I first started at Hotchkiss, I'd always liked diving and fiddled around with it as a youngster on Long Island, but didn't take it very seriously. I actually wanted to go into UDT while I was in the Navy, but my wife put the crunch on that one. So,
what is UDT?
Underwater demolition work. So, when I got to Hotchkiss, there was a group of guys, it was boys' school at that time, wanted to form a scuba club. And they approached me, and I said, would I be the advisor to it? I said, yes, sort of grudgingly, because I didn't feel like I knew enough to really be their advisor. We had one tank. We took turns swimming around in the pool in it. And I finally decided, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. And I brought in an instructor from West Hartford who taught classes there for at least a year or two. And then he approached me, he said, why don't you go off and get your instructor certification? So I did. That was 1975, and that's how I got started scuba diving.
Was Ted Davis involved in that at all?
He wasn't. He was a diver.
Okay.
He was kind of a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants diver, but that didn't make him a bad diver. He was actually quite a good diver. And he and I started diving in the lake together. That's the first lake dives I did was with Ted Davis. And Jeanette Axelby, too.
Oh, yes.
Both of them very, very good divers.
You also did some diving at some of the ore pits in the area.
Right. At the time, when I moved here, I didn't know they were ore pits. They looked like ponds. But you can't stay long in this area without hearing about the iron industry and finding out about the mining and things. And I became rather intrigued by it and began to explore some of the pits. And the one that I spent most time in was what was called the Mammoth, I believe, and Union ore pits. It's the one on Route 44, at the intersection of 44 and 112. And with actually some students that I taught to dive, we would explore through in these pits. We went there and into the Deep Lake ore pit, which is really known as the Chatfield ore bed. Those are the two that we explored the most.
Well, the Mammoth and Union we know as the Ore Hill.
Ore Hill, right.
I just want to clarify that one.
That's right.
Okay, and you did get into the Chatfield, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, yeah.
And that was on the property of?
Sam Burke.
Deep Lake Farm.
Yeah, he owned the property at that time. He was alive and well, and he gave me a tour of it and told me a lot of the history of it and was happy that I was interested in exploring it.
And when you dove into that particular pit, did you find anything on the bottom?
Found a lot of tools, shovels, shoes. We found some very large barrels sitting on top of one of the steep drop-offs. Large wooden barrels that my belief is they were probably filled with water, and it was a way to get water down to the guys working down in the pits with their picks and shovels. The other thing we found was a wagon sitting on the bottom in about 50 feet of water, and that puzzled me until I talked with, I think it was Sam, it might have been his son John, told me that, well, at one time they actually took ice off the lake for the ice industry, off the top of the pit when it was frozen, and he told me that they knew that a horse and wagon had gone through at one point in time, Well, as I said, the wagon's there, but
no horse
at the moment.
Now, you told me a wonderful story about the red tide.
Yes. It was about, this would have been in the middle to late 1970s. Lakeville Lake was experiencing a problem with an algae called oscillatory rubescence.
Do I have to spell
that? No, you don't have
to. I can deal with red tide.
Right.
Okay.
And when the cells of this blue-green algae would die, it's a cold water algae, when they would die, they'd come to the surface and turn red, blood red. So there were a couple of years where there was a period of time in May and early June that the lake surface was just blood red. And this, everybody got very concerned about this. In fact, that really spawned the creation of the Lakeville Lake Association. But I was asked to look into the possibility, because rumors always had it that there were connections through shafts from the Ore Hill mine and maybe even the Chatfield mine, which were strip mines, but they had been, after they got all the surface ore out, they went to shaft mining, and the rumor was that there were shafts that connected with the lake. And that's where the redness was coming from. Well, it was disproven in two ways. One, Ted Davis discovered it was oscillatory rubescence, which is an algae. It had nothing to do with iron ore. And the other was Charlotte Reed asked me to form a committee to look into this possibility that there were shaft connections. And we debated it at a couple of meetings, and I had explored that area and said, I've never seen a shaft opening. And then we brought a fellow named Fred Lubischer, who was a well-known character in town and quite a good engineer, onto the committee, and he, within 5 minutes, explained why there couldn't be a shaft opening, because the altitude of the surface of Lakeville Lake is, I believe, roughly 735 to 738 feet. The Ore Hill mine was at a little over 800 feet. And there couldn't be that kind of difference if there was a major connection between the two. There could be some minor seepage, but
perfect.
No major connection.
Just perfect. When you came to this area, at some point, you bought a house in Lime Rock.
Yes.
Would you tell me about that house, please?
Well, it was by coincidence. Actually, we bought the house before I got into exploring the ore mines around, but the house we bought was on Old Furnace Road. And it was one of the miners' cottages. I know I told you I'd try to find it, but I, for the life of me, can't remember the address on Old Furnace.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, okay. But if you go into that little, wonderful little community in this valley where Salmon Kill Road comes out, and we really loved it there. And almost all the houses, with the exception of maybe two at that time, were involved with the Barnum Richardson Iron Company. Right across the street was Mrs. Singleton Fish, who lived in a house that was on the property of the old forge of the Barnum Richardson Company. So I really got to know the iron industry kind of from a different perspective by living
did.
In that house.
Do you remember when you bought the house?
1971.
And you said you paid
$27,500.
Lucky you.
Yeah, I always told my students I paid more for my last car than I did for my first house.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. You have a business that you run, Marine Study Company?
Yeah, it's now a little over 20 years ago, I started a small company called Marine Study Program, Inc. It's an S corporation, soon to become an LLC.
What's an S corporation?
It means small corporation. It's a type of corporation that's not interested in raising capital by selling shares. It's really, you create it as a liability protection.
Okay.
But teaching diving, and I also began to get involved in, I did a lot of work up in Lake Champlain on historic wrecks and headed up some projects up there. And then we got involved in invasive weed control in the lakes around here, because just at that time also Eurasian milfoil was making its ugly appearance in a lot of our lakes, which
what,
is a...
What kind of milfoil?
Eurasian milfoil, which is an invasive weed that can really take over a body of water. So I got involved in all kinds of projects to try to control invasive weed from laying benthic barriers. Benthic barriers are it's nothing more than underwater mulching of laying down landscape cloth is really what it is. So that's why I formed the Marine Study Program.
You're busy. What we're doing, you're still doing repairs for the chimes.
Yes, on occasion. Yes, on occasion.
And you've got this.
Yeah.
Isn't it nice to be retired?
Yeah.
Now, you told me that you had some civic activities.
Yes. Probably the first of the civic activities I got involved in was when I was fairly new in town, I ran for office as the alternate on the Zoning Board of Appeals, which I somehow won, and I really didn't even know what my job was at that time, but that got me involved in civic affairs. I then served on the Recreation Commission for a while, but at the moment I don't know if these qualify as civic activities, but
yeah.
I was also asked in the late 70s, actually it was 78, to join the board of Litchfield Bancorp, at that time Litchfield Savings Bank, and mm-hmm. I've been on that board ever since, and I've chaired the board for the last 20 years.
And there's another bank board that you're on?
Connecticut Mutual Holding Company is a company we formed, we being Northwest Community Bank, which is up in Winsted, and Litchfield Bancorp formed to kind of combine some of our backroom operations to realize economies of scale. We've subsequently brought in a third bank, which is Collinsville Savings Society. So Connecticut Mutual Holding Company owns those three banks. And I chair the board of that company also.
Have you been on the Board of Finance?
I got elected to the Board of Finance as we sit here today. I guess it was about 19 years ago. Got elected three times. The first time I got elected, I thought it was a 2-year term, and I found out afterwards it was actually a 6-year term.
Oh, what a shock!
So I've been elected three times.
Okay.
I've been on. What else have I done? I'm on the. I was asked to be on the board of the ambulance, Salisbury Volunteer Ambulance. Society. I don't mean society. Service.
Association. Service.
And then I was asked to chair that board, which I currently do. I listed them for you. Help me out here.
Okay. Audubon?
I started as a feeder of Audubon. When I took a sabbatical from Hotchkiss for a year, I wanted to keep busy and get involved in something. So I went over weekly, sometimes twice a week, and fed the hawks and owls and eagle, and got involved with them and served on their stewardship board and actually chaired their first stewardship board.
Excellent.
I also...
Marketplace Association?
I'm now on the board of the Marketplace of Salisbury, which owns the buildings where the Levon's Market is.
Pollution Authority?
Oh, that's right. How could I forget that? I serve on the Salisbury Water Pollution Control Authority, and I actually chair that board also.
And is that also considered the Sewer Commission?
Yes, otherwise known as the Sewer Commission.
Oh, right.
Which I have to tell you is actually quite an interesting undertaking to be involved with it. It's very much like running a business.
Oh, sure.
Because it is, in a sense. It's a municipal business.
A small aside, but I ran the Chatfield Hill Water Company for 9 years.
Okay, so you know it very much.
I know what it is.
It's a matter of making sure that the rates pay the bills.
Yep. Yep. And that the water flows.
That's right.
Anything else that you'd like to add?
I think that's it.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you.